Prostitution is often trivialized and sometimes even glamorized in popular media, but the reality is far different. For many women and girls, it's a life of virtual slavery with few avenues of escape. The Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women wants people to understand just what sex trafficking really is and is launching an education campaign. Its director, Kara Jabola-Carolis, is with us in our studio. Kara, good morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
Coming in.
Thanks for having me. My mom is screaming right now. This is my first time on HPR.
All right. Well, congratulations. This is timed with the RIMPAC military exercise to coincide with that RIMPAC exercise. Why?
Well, we want to bring attention to the outsized demand for prostitution in Hawaii, which spikes during RIMPAC. National data shows that when you have large gatherings of men, such as the Super Bowl, 2014, 2015, the demand for prostitution surges by 30 to 39% in those two instances. And you also see an increase in the supply because networks travel toward that demand. And so we're concerned about women's safety in Hawaii and the impact here during RIMPAC and also outside of RIMPAC.
You were telling me earlier that even outside of a large-scale gathering like this, that Hawaii is a very high user of prostitution.
That's right. So one of the most innovative research schools on this issue is at Arizona State University. And their lead researcher concluded that Hawaii has one of the worst demand problems in America when it comes to prostitution, and that a lot of that demand and the buyers are on military bases. So this really comes at no surprise to us because of our economy here based on tourism and military. A lot of young men, middle-aged men of all ages actually, coming here to have a good time, and that can often include prostitution and engagement with the sex industry.
What are the elements of an education campaign that you feel will resonate with this audience?
Well, I think we need to talk about the impact of a high military presence and a high tourism presence here in Hawaii. We're doing an online digital campaign. We are doing bus ads, radio ads. We're also engaging the community through trainings. So this is stuff that you can see throughout the next couple of months.
What kind of things would happen in a training?
Well, talking about, I mean, having an honest conversation, first of all, about the sex trade in Hawaii, its genesis, the role of Western intervention in creating it, what it really looks like. So understanding the supply, the demand, survivor stories, giving equal value to those stories, and also talking about where our needs are at and how to identify trafficking. So that's a lot of different things, right? But
yeah.
It's really just opening the conversation in a broader way.
What is the effect of the impact of Western governments in creating prostitution?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in Hawaii, we know that the military directly developed the sex trade through its role regulating the industry during World War II, for example. And in other countries, the Philippines, Thailand, the United States actually had arrest and recreation agreements that obligated those countries to develop the sex industry around bases. So that's why we see at home and abroad, thriving sex industries around military bases still to this day. So the U.S. government, as well as local government, has played a role in developing this industry, even though measures have been taken recently to prohibit its expansion, at least on paper.
What's life like for a sex worker in Honolulu today?
Well, back up. I think that we talk about the terms that we use, the people who are in the sex trade here, they're very diverse, right? So on one end, it's a spectrum. We have women who are here that have been trafficked in a very brutal way. On the other end of that spectrum are women who have a lot of choices, who might identify as consensual sex workers. In between that is a lot of gray, a lot of coercion. And so asking the question, what does it look like, would really depend on where you are at in that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. At the lower rent end of the spectrum, let's just say.
Well, from some of the survivors who I've spoken to, the experience can range from just being really disconnected and alienated from your body. So feeling bored, irritated, humiliated. And then other times feeling terror, feeling a lot of physical pain. What you can imagine having sex with men who you don't know, meeting their sexual demands through, you know, force, either physically or through economic circumstances, isn't pleasant for a lot of women.
One of your posters makes a link between post-traumatic stress syndrome as experienced by members of the military and PTSD among prostitutes.
Yeah, so data suggests that women who have been sex trafficked exhibit high levels of PTSD, which not only come from their time in the trade, but also because of sexual trauma they experienced that led them to the trade. And that's something, of course, that we don't often consider when thinking about prostitution or the sex industry here. So that's something that we wanted to highlight with our messaging.
Is part of the message that if young men knew what life was like for young women in the trade, they might be a little bit more sympathetic, reluctant to take part?
I think you hit it on the head. Yes, I do. I think that, you know, this campaign isn't just about RIMPAC. RIMPAC is a symptom and not the disease. The disease is men's perceptions and behaviors towards women. And if we can tap into expanding empathy, expanding the public's image of women in the trade and humanizing women in the trade, I think it would be much harder to participate.
What are the things that dehumanize? Does popular culture play a role?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we are taught to just normalize sexualizing women. I think that, you know, for example, the military, places with a lot of military concentration, see higher levels of violence against women because it's a result of a bigger process about normalizing violence. So I think that we value male violence, even though we say that we don't. I think that our behaviors really value male violence and protect it, and that we view women, especially women in prostitution, as less than or less worthy of respect than regular women. But I think that it seeps both ways.
Thanks very much for bringing that to and this campaign begins today. Kara Jabrola-Corollis is the director of the State Commission on the Status of Women, which is launching an education campaign today about prostitution and sex trafficking in Hawaii. You can learn more about it on our Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet. And as usual, we get some guidance on it from that expert of such things, Christopher Phillips. We're welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter, visible in the south just after sunset, joined by Mars in the east at around 9 p.m. The moon this week will be passing through its last quarter phase with dark skies returning to the islands by week's end.
You have a discovery relating to one of the moons of Saturn?
Yes, once again, we are hearing about the discovery of organic molecules within the solar system, this time from the icy moon Enceladus, which is one of Saturn's larger moons. The data was actually collected some time ago by the Cassini spacecraft. We also learned recently of organic molecules on Mars. However, the discovery on Enceladus could be vastly more significant.
And is this going to get the huge hype from NASA, or they kind of learned their lesson on the last one, kind of be careful until they have a spaceship to show somebody?
It seems that way. This one almost flew under the radar.
And when we say organic molecules, it's not something that your everyday person on Earth would look at and go, man, that's a sign of life. It's a little bit more complicated than that.
It is indeed. Organic molecules come in all shapes and sizes. Any molecule that contains hydrogen and carbon atoms could be considered organic. So this means it could be a lot of different things. Basically, they use spectroscopy to analyze the chemical signatures of plumes erupting from Enceladus. And these chemical signatures can tell you what kind of atoms are present in the object they're looking at.
And what would be the difference between these two discoveries?
Well, the main thing is Mars is as dead as a doornail. There is no evidence to suggest that life exists on the red planet, and the Martian environment is hostile to say the least. Enceladus, on the other hand, is one of the most likely places in the solar system where we might find actual living organisms.
They're going to be way beneath the surface, though, right? Because it's going to be freezing up there.
Yep. So if there is life on Enceladus, it will be beneath the thick layer of ice in what we suspect is a subsurface ocean. And that ocean is heated from within. So right there, we have two essential ingredients for life, water and heat.
So it's probably like the abominable snowman.
Well, unless he's learned to swim, I don't think we'll find him there.
It's Christopher Phillips, and more fun as we examine our interesting solar system around us. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of one of the movies of legendary Hawaiian comedian Hilo Hattie. Hattie, born Clarissa Hiley in 1901, was one of the world's most prominent ambassadors of aloha. She enjoyed a lengthy career spanning almost six decades, earning fame as a singer, actor, and hula dancer. She was known for the jaunty tunes that blended local Hawaiian humor with elements of vaudeville, such as Hilo Hattie Does the Hilo Hop and The Cockeyed Mayor of Kona Kakai. In addition to releasing a number of musical and comedy albums on the Columbia and Decca record labels, she enjoyed fame on the silver screen. Between 1942 and 1961, Hattie appeared in eight films, ranging from the musical comedy Song of the Islands to the war film Suicide Battalion. The final film she appeared in, however, is arguably her most well-known. For today's Backyard Quiz, what was the last movie Hilo Hattie appeared in? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Later this week, we'll be joined on this program by Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. He's coming to Hawaii to speak with local scientists, and all this week, we're going to be talking with some of the other local scientists. Today, we look at the decline of coral reefs around the world. It's a troubling sign for the planet's future. Corals are host to so many other creatures, and when reefs die, entire ecosystems can be wiped out. As bleaching events and human impacts continue to raise concerns, researchers at the University of Hawaii have found some pockets of resilience where damaged reefs have been able to slowly recover. Dr. Ku'ule Rogers of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology outlines some of the latest research for us.
We are seeing some signs of hope, but the status of the reefs right now is that from the 2014-2015 bleaching, there was extensive damage. In 14 and 15, it's not recovering that fast. And the reason is that corals are slow growing. So it takes a long time for reefs to come back. If an area is completely devastated, it can take 50 to 100 years for corals to come back because they're so slow growing.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened here in 2014-15, we had the warming that came down from the north and hit Kauai really badly in 2014, and then in 15, up from the Big Island. So Big Island had 30 to 85% bleaching and nearly 50% mortality in some places. Statewide, the bleaching was 30%, over 30% loss. Here on Oahu, we weren't affected as much. Kaneohe Bay, here on the east side, had over 20% mortality, but Hanauma Bay on the south shore had only about 10% mortality. But these corals don't just come back right away unless the temperatures return to normal. But if they are actually dead, if they actually have mortality, then it takes much longer for the reefs to recover. And, of course, the reefs are associated with all of the other organisms, the invertebrates, the fishes, and everything else.
Well, and the bleaching is a direct result of rising ocean temperatures. Is that right?
It is a direct response of rising ocean temperatures, and it's a direct the ocean temperature rising is a direct response from the anthropogenic inputs of the emissions into the atmosphere. So that's something we have to really be aware of and how we can change this.
Anthropogenic meaning we've entered
human.
Entered an era in which humans now affect the planet, right?
Yes, and this has not only increased the temperatures in the oceans, but it's also increased the ocean. It's also changed the ocean chemistry, where you have what is termed ocean acidification, so that the pHs are lower, and this is affecting a number of organisms, including corals, which have to calcify and need the pH in the ocean to be a certain level.
You've described what you refer to as oases. What happens there?
Oases would be areas of more resilience. There, throughout the state, there was different levels of mortality. There was much different, high variability. Some areas didn't bleach at all. Other areas bleached completely. At Lisianski, at Papahanaumokuakea in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, they were completely wiped out. They had 100% bleaching at pretty deep area depths. So there are local impacts and local currents and other things that will cause certain areas not to be affected as much as other areas. So these oases, or these areas that are really important to coral reefs, so we can start to learn about what things are necessary and what species are doing better than other species.
And we don't necessarily know what made them, these areas you describe, into oases, do we?
Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. We do know that there's more extensive bleaching overall in shallower waters, although it has happened, it does happen in deeper waters as well. We do know that there are areas of upwelling or currents or Hawaii. Many of these areas are near very deep. Our land drops off very rapidly, so those are cooler waters in those areas. We do know that certain species are affected more than others. So in areas that have more of those species that aren't affected as much, those species will do better, those areas.
Is it possible to, by studying the areas that have rebounded, the areas of coral reef that have rebounded faster than others, is it possible for us to, you know, find ways to promote whatever it is that allowed them to survive better?
It is. And right now, we have, the governor has the initiative, the 30 by 30. This is protecting 30% of the state's reefs by 2030. So myself and a number of organizations, the state, the federal government, nonprofit organizations like TNC, the Nature Conservancy, all getting together and deciding which of these areas would be best to set aside. And these would be areas that are not as affected, as well as some that are, but areas that may have a better chance in the future. Some of the predictive models that the NOAA's Coral Reef Watch has shown that in the future, coral bleaching will be approximately every 6 years And by the year 2055, bleaching events will be annual. So it's really important to understand right now what is happening, and also to do what we can on land to make sure that these levels of carbon dioxide don't continue to increase at such a rapid rate.
What can we do on land, Cooley?
There's a lot of solutions. Everybody knows reuse, recycle, but some of the things they don't understand is that you can really lessen your carbon impact by thinking of the true cost of everything you buy. What's the cost to the environment? Ask yourself, how was it made? How far away did it come from? Am I going to recycle it or just throw it away? Buy local foods and goods. They aren't associated with carbon costs. And this is especially true here in Hawaii, where over 90% of our resources are shipped in. A main thing is to eat lower on the food chain. It will significantly reduce the impact to the planet because it takes 10 times more energy every time you go up that food chain. So what I mean by this is if it takes 10 pounds of corn or soybeans to make 1 pound of beef or pork and a lot of wasted water, we can become part of that solution if we eat more fruits and vegetables and less meat and fish. Education is extremely important. We have to educate the public as well as our legislators and our managers, and we have to start adopting the different solutions that these new earth-friendly technologies are coming out with, whether it's electric cars, solar panels, whatever the next step is. We have to do our part when we can to be able to take these further steps to help.
Dr. Kuʻulei Rogers is an associate researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, principal investigator of the Coral Reef Ecology Lab, and co-founder of the Coral Reef Assessment and Monitoring Program. If you're in any doubt as to whether your vote matters, look no further than Oahu's upcoming city council races. Their outcome will determine such matters as how much property tax you pay, whether you'll be paying out of pocket for key city services. It's all about factions within the current council, and Natanya Friedheim has that story in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Natanya.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. This is kind of a can't tell the players without a scorecard kind of story, right? Right now you've got it, the city council divided into a 5-4, two different voting blocks, yeah?
Yes, so at the city council we don't have parties like Democrats, Republicans, but having just observed the city council, you know, going to meetings, you sort of see that on certain issues there are two groups who typically vote together, and it doesn't affect all issues. So things like funding homeless services, affordable housing projects, even rail, it's not always on these particular faction lines, but there are issues where definitely you can see it play out.
What are the issues where it really is distinctive?
So the most obvious example for me is last year, Mayor Caldwell introduced a slew of tax and fee increases. And so, you know, the mayor will introduce that and they have to go through all these readings with the city council. And this then a minority faction had consistently voted against them all the way up till the end. At the end, vehicle weight tax and parking meter fees increased, but on a 5-4 vote. So that was one example. So you can sort of see that one faction perhaps is more willing to increase taxes and fees, and the other one takes sort of a more consistent stance against that.
Well, this is a pretty good example of how your vote affects your life, right?
If you
feel that way about some of these fees, you better get to the ballot box. How is this all likely to change in the fall?
Well, there are four city council seats that are up for re-election, or Councilmember Ernie Martin, who is the current chair, is actually his term is ending, and so his seat is up. And, you know, we're going to see some people who are currently on the council. There's going to be some pretty tough races, and then one thing you're going to see is some council members tend to support certain initiatives by Mayor Caldwell and others don't. So depending on who is elected into office, how easy it is for Mayor Caldwell to work on his projects and get some of his initiatives through is going to be either easier or more difficult.
We're seeing some familiar names return to the political scene in upcoming council races, are we?
Definitely. So Bobby Bunda, who has spent a lot of time at the state legislature, is running for the first time for city council. I'm sure voters will notice his name. And another one is Tommy Waters, who was formerly in the State House of Representatives, is running against Councilman Trevor Ozawa. Last year, the two were in a race, and Waters actually lost to Ozawa by 41 votes, so it should be an interesting race and interesting to see how that plays out.
I don't doubt it, Natanya. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
That was reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org. Desalination has an almost alchemical quality. The process offers the alluring possibility of a nearly unlimited supply of water for drinking and agriculture from an otherwise unusable source. But there's a catch. Current desalination technology uses a lot of energy. Most plants are powered by fossil fuel, generating a great deal of carbon pollution in the process. A test project on Hawaii Island aims to change that equation. The state's Natural Energy Laboratory on Hawaii Island recently received a Department of Energy grant to develop a solar-powered desalination plant. To learn more about the project, the conversation's Ryan Finity spoke with Greg Barber, Executive Director of the Natural Energy Laboratory of Hawaii Authority.
The intention of the Department of Energy is to find new technologies that can bring down the cost of desalinated water, and also find technologies that can be developed for use off the grid where the need for electrical power for desalination is not available. And the technology, forward osmosis, uses much less power because it needs to have high temperature water to make the membrane work. And in typical reverse osmosis, the company that's desalinating will pump the pressure up or pressurize the water to a very high pressure and then force it through the membrane to desalinate the water to take out the impurities and to take out the salt. This technology, when you have high temperature water, and the membrane that they're using, the actual water is pulled through the membrane and you don't need that high temperature. So the idea is that you can bring down the cost of desalination dramatically, as well as use it in areas where there's no grid connection. There's a lot of areas around the world where water is needed for agricultural purposes in remote locations, but there's no grid connection. So this technology really would be beneficial for agricultural as well as producing drinking water.
To get a better understanding of the science behind desalination, I called Wendell Ila. He's a desalination specialist at Murdoch University in Perth, Australia.
There's two ways you do desalination. You either do it by phase change or you do it by physical separation. So phase change is like boiling water. So you'd be familiar with just taking a kettle of water, put it on the stove, boil it, steam comes off. The steam doesn't have any salt in it. So if your kettle of water had salt in it initially with the water, only the steam would come off with no salt. Then you can just grab that steam, condense it, and you got pure water. That's distillation. but it's gone through a phase change. That's one way to desalinate water. The other way to desalinate water is by separating it through a non-phase change. That's reverse osmosis, osmosis, things like that, where the water never changes phase, never goes from liquid to gas or gas to solid or that sort of thing. It always stays liquid.
And non-phase change is how most desalination plants around the world operate, correct?
Yes. Most is probably an overstatement. About probably 40% of the plants now are still phase change, but they're almost all in Middle Eastern countries where energy is very cheap because it costs an extra energy to do a phase change. So if you have oil is essentially free, then actually phase change has some advantages because you can go to higher concentrations of salts. Less prone to fouling, because otherwise you have to have a membrane that can foul up and lose its permeability. So there are advantages with phase change, but you pay an energy price. And so unless energy's cheap, everybody goes with non-phase change, meaning membrane-type processes.
And what is it about a non-phase change that makes it more energy efficient?
It's that the phase change for water is a very energy intensive change. It takes about 15 times more energy to change the phase of water from liquid to gas than it does just to raise the water 1 degree C. Whereas if you keep it in the same phase, now you're just really employing pressure to push it through. The pressure takes energy. But it doesn't take, it probably takes on the order of 10 to 20 times less energy to push it through a membrane than to change its phase.
The project here in Hawaii is trying to purify water, desalinate water, using a solar-powered mm-hmm. system. Are the energy requirements for most of the desalination plants we see around the world too great for current renewable sources?
No, not actually. And that's an area that there is a lot of active research, and I'm sure that's what's motivated the DOE initiative, is to try to get more renewables incorporated. The biggest trick with renewables is not that you can't generate the amount of energy. It's number one, that it usually takes a much bigger footprint to get the energy. So to get a megawatt of energy from solar, you're talking about a few acres of solar panels. To get a megawatt from oil or from something like that, we're talking about 100 gallons. So, you know, much smaller volumes and equipment's needed. But the sun is free, oil's not. You got greenhouse effects, things, so there's a lot of trade-offs there. But in terms of just density of energy, renewables are tough that way. The other thing that hurts renewables is their intermittency. Renewables like the sun, it comes up every day, it goes down. So you got at a maximum, you know, half a day, 12 hours on average of sun. The other time you got dark. So if you want to run a water treatment process, they like to run best at just steady. So they're running 24/7, same rate all the time, producing water. So you have to have a system, a water treatment system that you adapt to being either intermittently on and off to suit the renewables or speed up and slow down, depending on the intensity of the renewables, i.e. wind or direct solar as a function of time of day. Or you have to have a energy storage device of some way. So you generate the energy by renewables when it's there, you store it, and then you can run your water treatment at a steady rate 24/7. The energy storage is very expensive right now. It's more expensive by far than the energy generator itself from a renewables perspective. And so that's kind of the technological challenge, is to adapt water treatment, which likes to be kind of a steady state running all the time, is when it's most efficient, to an energy source that doesn't produce all the time, that's up and down.
And how about environmental impacts, Wendell? Is there a consequence of pulling that much seawater out of the ocean and then all that salt has to go somewhere. What about the byproducts of this process?
There's a finite amount of water in the world. There's a finite amount of salt, essentially. And you're really not changing that much. What you're doing is making your own hydrologic cycle, smaller hydrologic cycle. You're not actually taking particularly more water out of the ocean than you would otherwise by taking it from, say, surface water, groundwater, so on and so forth. You're just short-circuiting it, because eventually all the salt gets cycled in and out of the ocean via usually by mineralogic processes, geologically slow processes. The water gets cycled on the hydrologic cycle that we all know about, you know, rain, rivers, back to the ocean, back up again in rain, that type of thing. So the amount of what we're doing is we're making a shorter cycle. So we're pulling the water out, putting the salt right back in. But the water also ends up back in the ocean. It's not like it's lost from the hydrologic cycle. So you're depleting the ocean over time of water. You're just having two much faster processes, both of getting the fresh water as well as cycling the salt, where the salt normally takes billions of years to cycle. So it's more a time issue than there is any inherent environmental difference. The big inherent environmental difference is on the energy side. And that is this thing of renewables versus non-renewables.
That was Wendell Ela, professor of water treatment and desalination at Murdoch University in Perth, Australia, speaking with conversation producer Ryan Finnerty. Earlier, we heard from executive director of the National Energy Laboratory of Hawaii's executive director, Greg Garber. For a link to more information about the solar desalination project on Hawaii Island, you can visit hawaiipublicradio.org. Now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. While she was celebrated primarily for her music, the famed Hawaiian comedienne Hilo Hattie appeared in a number of films during her career, ranging from serious war movies to casual flicks that depicted laid-back island life. Hattie's presence in these films injected a whimsical warmth that reflected her true-life personality. While 1948's Miss Tatlock's Millions and 1953's City Beneath the Sea are lost to obscurity today, Hattie's final film endures as one of the most iconic set in Hawaii. In 1961, Hilo Hattie appeared alongside the King of Rock and Roll himself in the musical comedy Blue Hawaii as the character Waihila. Blue Hawaii was the first of three movies starring Elvis Presley to be filmed in Hawaii, but it was Hilo Hattie's last hurrah on the big screen. And Michelle Grotstein of Kaneohe was the first to get that answer right. She said the film with the scene flashed in her mind, and she really enjoyed the quiz. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, committed to accelerating literacy and learning for students throughout the state, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The worlds of science and art somehow got separated by history, and it's up to artists like Michelle Schwengel-Regala to bring them back again. Her next show was inspired by a dive trip to Antarctica. It's called Frozen Floating, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me here.
What was this trip to Antarctica? How did that come about?
This trip was supported by the National Science Foundation. It's an organization that I think most people think of as an organization that supports research scientists, mm-hmm. but it also has an initiative that's been going on for decades that invites artists, writers, people of different creative disciplines to apply to be a part of this program. So my collaborator, Kirsten Carlson, and I applied in 2016, and we were accepted in June of 2017 to go to McMurdo Station. That's the largest research station American research station in Antarctica. And we were there for 7 weeks.
What a fantastic opportunity.
It was indeed.
What time of the year?
It's considered the austral summer. It's, let's see, we were there October, November, beginning of December. So during most of those days, the sun never set during our time there. It was it was quite surreal in that regard. It was the, I like to call it the longest day that I've been away from my family.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. At the same time, how cold was it?
You know, we, you and I, Chris, have experience growing up or living in Madison, Wisconsin.
Right.
And I felt that was going to be potential good training for me to be in this cold, cold habitat. And indeed, the temperatures I experienced in Antarctica were comparable to the things I grew up with in Wisconsin. The coldest temperature in the air was something like 28, some below zero. Wind chills worse than that. But for the most part, it was in the teens most days. So it was not as extreme as I'd expected. But certainly, I was in a quite mild part of the continent.
To a Wisconsin girl, that's quite bearable.
Sure.
Temperature in the teens.
Sure.
What kind of things did you see?
It was quite strange to go from, you know, verdant Hawaii through New Zealand, another very green habitat, into a place that is almost barren. You know, you see the ice fields and maybe in the distance you may see mountains, but the color range was so different. It was shades of blue. And you, if you saw barren land, it would be dark rock, but there were no plants. There were few animals. It took me some days before I saw any topside animals. So it was such a shock to be in a place that seemed so desolate. But at the same time, once we were able to get our checkout dives done, once we went under the ice and we saw the marine habitat, then the color was all right there back for us.
Well, the next thing I was going to ask you after what did you see was what did you hear? And let's hear an example. Well, I think we should quiz our audience as to what was that.
Should I disclose what it was?
I think we should, yeah.
Okay. Those were the vocalizations of Weddell seals. Those are marine mammals. They're the southernmost reproductive mammals in the world. And they're similar to monk seals in their size, their general shape, a bit larger, but they are the most common creature that I saw. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. They're the only vertebrate that I saw underwater, but they would make their presence known during almost every one of our dives. We would hear those mechanical or almost alien-like sounds during every dive. And then the beginning thumping was very percussive. If they were close, if they were making quite a loud one, we would feel that vibration in our chest cavities.
Through the water.
It was amazing.
What other things did you see underwater?
You know, because of the requirements for diving, I had to do a number of preliminary dives here in Hawaii. And so I became accustomed to all the, you know, lush things that we see here. And then I wasn't expecting quite as much in Antarctica. But indeed, there was so much diversity. There were so many invertebrates of strange configurations and such a wide range of colors, you know, sea stars ranging from purple and magenta and yellows and oranges, and tunicates and giant sponges that I could almost sit inside. The scale of things was tremendous, and the sea spiders were also experiencing gigantism, this phenomenon where in isolation you may have a strange expansion of size range of a creature, and indeed that's what happened with the sea spiders in Antarctica.
Is that the same gigantism that's offered as an explanation for some of the dinosaurs of back in the day that just got completely huge?
I'll have to check and see, but the term seems like it's been applied to
I'm just wondering
branches.
where if an animal evolves more or less in isolation, it can get bigger and bigger.
That sounds right.
How do you make that into your art?
What
do you take from all this?
Because my background is first in science, I have this eye for looking at diversity, looking at, you know, comparing things. And then when I became a science illustrator, it was the kind of thing that I got to put that observation into action and make art about it. When I was down there, it was important to take photographs and take video of the creatures I was seeing and the strange habitat I was in, being under this ceiling of ice. But my collaborator, Kirsten, and I also endeavored to draw while we were underwater so we could do some immediate direct field sketching.
Wow.
So that was one of the most challenging aspects of our time underwater.
I bet.
But we were able to do it.
What do you draw on? I can't even imagine what new materials you would use for that.
In this setup, we used a plastic type of slate that is similar to what you might find in a dive shop here, but Christian's husband modified them to be larger and to suit our needs. And then on that tablet, we strapped this synthetic paper. It's called Yupo, and it's a polyester, a plastic paper.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't degrade the way pulp paper would. And that's lashed onto it's clamped onto our tablet, and then we have just regular graphite pencils. And they would work similar to the way you would on land, and so we were able to draw. Of course, having to wear three pairs of gloves on each hand,
yeah.
And the extremely cold temperatures, it was about 28.5 degree water Fahrenheit,
mm-hmm.
that limited our ability to be as dexterous as we like
to
be on land.
I was going to say, perhaps the detail would suffer a little bit.
But. Indeed, right. And we had to regulate our time underwater. It was usually maybe 20 to 44 minutes that we would be underwater during any dive. And so we couldn't draw that entire time, but we made the most of our time underwater.
Well, for you as a science illustrator, and I noticed you were sketching just as we sat down here. It's a form of language for you, isn't it?
It is.
Drawing what you see.
Right. It is able to, with a few strokes of a pencil or whatever stylus I'm using to draw, I can recreate that experience I was in. So when I look at this drawing that I just did this morning, later, I'll remember this conversation with you. I'll remember the scenario, different details of it that I don't need to write down in words, but it all comes flooding back. So the drawing underwater has a similar effect.
When I think of, you know, some of the great scientists of the past were extremely expert draftsmen, Audubon being just one of many mm-hmm. examples, but you were expected to be able to draw what you saw in earlier days of science, right?
Mm-hmm, right, and indeed that's how I got my job as a science illustrator, that my professor saw that I was drawing what I was supposed to be learning. So I was thankful for his vision and bringing that skill out in me.
Got you a trip to Antarctica.
Eventually it did. Who knew?
Who else can he even say that, much less know what a Weddell seal sounds like, right?
Well, there are a few folks here on Oahu who have done research or have worked in Antarctica, so I'm hoping to gather them all together at this reception that will happen on Saturday the 14th.
Yeah. And just be sure to wear warm clothing.
I am suggesting that people wear knitted mittens, hats, scarves, because we're gonna chill it down in that exhibit space.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chris.
Michelle Schwengel-Regala is Fishcakes Artist in Residence, and her show Frozen Floating opens on Saturday, July 14th at the Box Jelly in downtown Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Hawaii Realty, working with home buyers and sellers. This weekend's open houses on Oahu are featured online and interactive at openhousemadeeasy.com.
Hawaii is a perfect place to watch evolution in action. Aloha, this is Dr. Malia Rivera. I'm a scientist and educator and excited to be sharing with Ira Flatow ways we're trying to weave Hawaii place-based learning into STEM curriculums. We'll also talk about one of our island's quirky species radiations. Join us to learn more about it.
First Take with Science Friday at Hawaii Theater Center, July 6th. Tickets at hprtickets.org. Sponsored in part by Le Jardin Academy.
And we have to go, but up tomorrow we'll talk about the effects of climate change with coastal geologist Dolan Eversole. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HII Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook, and join us tomorrow.